Okay, so I'm on. Good evening. It's lovely to be with you again. I must say, Helen and I feel very warmly welcomed by you all. It's been great to be here. Thank you so much for that. Well, this evening, loving your neighbour at work. That sounds like a miracle, doesn't it? And after work, I'm going to start this talk with a little video clip, I hope.
Last year I met Laura. Laura was a senior executive in a large civil service department, and her boss was a nightmare. He believed he could do anything, he believed he could say anything, and get away with it. During this time, Laura had spent a season of life away from Christianity, but she returned to faith while she was working for him. And she'd been planning on leaving, since work had become so very unpleasant. But then she felt that God was calling her to stay, and to make an effort in improving her working relationship. And so Laura started praying, specifically for her boss and for their workload. Over the months, they developed a tentative respect for each other, and this gradually deepened into mutual trust, and eventually, a solid relationship was forged between them. After a season of working for this boss, Laura then felt God calling her in an entirely different direction, to apply for ordination. Part of this process involved getting a reference from her boss, which was weird and hard for Laura, because he hadn't expressed any interest in the Christian faith before then. But she had to get the reference to do the ordination training, and so she went ahead. And when she read what he'd written, she told me that she wept. He answered the referee questions about her character frankly, and he revealed just how much of Jesus he'd seen in her at work. He even said, if Laura ran the church, I'd go to it. And this from a non-churchgoer. Laura only knew about the impact of all her prayers several years later, but it didn't stop her praying for her boss throughout her working life, or in fact, for her whole team. As she walked the floor each morning, she would greet her team, and she would pray God's blessing on them for that day. In her heart, of course, not out loud. She prayed over work relationships, and she prayed over meetings, especially when she knew she had the scope to influence people more senior than her. She started to ask herself the question, how can I use the influence I have to move people towards God? And Laura learned from years of practice that God uses prayer, as well as the person who prays, to bring culture change, both small and big.
Okay, that video clip comes from something called Transforming Work, which is an 8-week course for people in the workplace that's recently been released by LICC. And on this slide, there's just a whole bunch of resources that the London Institute produces to help people in the workplace. I don't know whether you're connected to LICC, whether you get any of their information, any of their emails, but if you would like to be connected and you're not connected, Helen's got a sign-up sheet here, and if you write your email clearly on it, we can add you to the database so that you can get relevant stuff coming through. So, you know, feel free to sign up if that interests you. What Laura did in that video was to show Jesus to her boss through the relationship that she built, how she worked, the way she served somebody who was really very difficult. And getting a life, to use this morning's phrase, is in large measure about getting right relationships, because relationships today are under unquestionably tremendous pressure from the changing landscape at work. Longer working hours, less job security, always on technology, pressure of targets, sometimes workplace bullying, and so on. So I think that improving relationships and loving your neighbour is a really relevant and a really challenging topic at work. But even after work or outside of work, we can never take our relationships for granted, whether it's in marriage or in the wider circle of family and friends or in the community. And I really want you to be thinking about your own key relationships this evening. So this will be a combination of me sharing and, as usual, you doing a bit of work by doing some reflection together and taking some feedback as we go along. I promise you tomorrow there are no handouts, you won't have to do any work, and you can just listen tomorrow morning. But here's a roadmap for this seminar. First of all, love at work, is that really possible? And if so, how? Secondly, what are my relationships like, both at work and maybe outside of work, and how could I improve them? So let's start with your context. If we just pause for a moment, take out that handout that you've got. Hopefully you've got a pen. If not, there's some on the back table. And write down on your handout at the top of the first page the most significant relationships that you have. Now, if you're in active service, these could be individuals like your commanding officer or your closest colleagues or another team that's crucial to getting your work done well. If you're retired, these relationships could be family or friends or perhaps people you relate to in voluntary organisations or in the wider community. See if you can jot down perhaps at least 10 names or 10 relationships, because we're going to use this information as we go on. So I'll just give you a couple of minutes to think about that. Jot down the names, the key relationships that you have. Okay, looks like half of you are finished. Just give you another minute to think of any other people you want to note down on that. I had one guy in a previous seminar who wrote down the Inland Revenue because he absolutely hated them. So, love in active service, is that possible? I mean, so often the corrosive effect of self-interest causes people to snatch and grab, to exploit or to steal or cut corners or oppress people or marginalise or put other people down or ridicule them or judge them. I mean, all this is going on in the workplace, isn't it? Self-interest and selfishness may indeed deliver a short-term blip in performance in some ways, but of course it also turns places into emotional deserts where there's no forgiveness, no generosity, no trust, places where everybody just looks after themselves. And yet God loves the people around us. Amazing though that may sometimes seem. Yeah, he loves your commanding officer. He wants people to experience his love, and often their first experience of what that love is through us. It's through us, the people that God has sent to be his body wherever we are. And of course, the two main planks of Jesus' teaching were the great commandment, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment, and the second is like it, love your neighbour as yourself. And this is just as applicable for our workplace colleagues as our neighbour down the street, or the refugee in clear and present need. And in the Great Commandment, Jesus is encouraging us to look at all of life through a lens, through a relational lens, and consider how what we're doing serves God and the good of other people, not seeking our own good, but the good of others. Because our workplaces can be so rough and demanding sometimes, we have to start out by asking ourselves the question, well, does love cut the mustard at work? Is it too soft and woolly? UPS delivers, but does love? You know, will love really help your unit deliver its goals? Will love really help your commanding officer deliver theirs? Will love really help you deliver yours? Well, in the workplace, human relations can be treated with a sort of narrow pastoral interpretation of what love means. Sometimes love means assertiveness in a certain context. You know, confrontation and assertion often take place in a pressurized context where we're striving towards a common goal. But Christians, in my experience, tend not to be so comfortable with that kind of expression of love. They're not comfortable with being assertive. And on the whole, we're not that good at assertiveness. Now, I don't know whether that's different in the military, but as I encounter a lot of Christians, I would say that's true. And yet, we see in the Gospels, Jesus expressing love in all sorts of ways, yes, acts of healing and forgiveness, but also teaching and equipping his disciples, and sometimes with stern warnings and confrontation and rebukes. We see that from Jesus. So our Christian love also needs to be able to confront and be assertive when appropriate if our goal is truly to help others to flourish. At the London Institute, we run a program called Executive Toolbox, which is designed to help senior people in business have a transformational effect in their workplace. And one of the guys on the Executive Toolbox program was a guy called Andrew, who was in an organization that practiced what they called forced ranking. Now, it's not ranking is perhaps not the same use of the word as it is in the military. In forced ranking, you have to assess your people according to a bell-shaped curve, and no matter how good the whole unit or how bad the whole unit is, there's always 10% in the bottom category. You know, that's what's called forced ranking. Now, that ranking is done subjectively by the perception of the management team. I don't know, you may have a similar system in the military, I don't know, but this is what happened in his organisation. And Andrew had a man working for him who, in this forced ranking, was repeatedly ranked below acceptable, even though, by the management team, even though Andrew knew that he did a good job. And Andrew's boss was something of a bully, in contrast to Andrew, who's actually a rather quiet sort of guy. And occasionally, the boss would just say to Andrew, get rid of this guy in his team. You know, he's always in the bottom 10%, and Andrew would quietly resist and turn the conversation onto something else. But as he prayed about it, he became increasingly convinced that the only way to handle his boss was to be assertive himself. And one day, the moment of truth came. Andrew found himself in a meeting with his boss and this guy who worked for him. And after a while, his employee left, and the boss immediately said, get rid of him. I don't care how you do it, just do it. And with a quick arrow prayer, Andrew spoke up and said, you're wrong and you're out of line. And stood there waiting for his dismissal. He waited for an angry response. But instead of reacting badly, his boss pulled up a chair and said, really? Why? And there then followed a more honest conversation about this guy than had ever happened before. The way he was perceived, what he actually did. And the result was, when the next ranking session came round, Andrew's boss actually stood up for the guy and stopped him from being ranked below acceptable. See, sometimes assertiveness can be the loving thing to do. Can anybody think of a situation in your working environment where being assertive was the loving thing to do? Anybody think of that? No, it would result in immediate dismissal, wouldn't it? I'm not sure. Yeah?
I've got one.
Go on then.
I was a newly appointed engineer of one of the Majesty's destroyers, about which I knew absolutely nothing other than the paper course that I'd done before I joined it. We went to sea for my first sea week and came back alongside. And unfortunately, we had to berth the ship starboard side two. My captain wanted it berthed port side two so that he'd be facing the right way when he left, and he didn't have to make a cock up and a pretty quick turn on the way out under the nose of Secretary Seymour and so on. And he said, your deputy has forced me to park this way round. And the reason was that the fuel system was aligned such that you could only. If you took fuel from here, you had to be this way around. Yeah. That's the way it was. And the one thing I'd learned was this thing about the fuel system. And the other bit of intelligence I gleaned was the fact the navigator had told my deputy which way around he wanted to be. And that meant that we had to use the fuel from there, and so on. And I said, most uncharacteristically, most unlikely, I said, actually, sir, you're wrong. Your navigator told me to do this, and this is the way you are. And you know, for the next 18 months, I have no trouble from that command.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good example. Now, I'm not trying to turn you all into bully boys, you know, in this. I don't think assertion is always the right way to go. But if I had to look across the spectrum of human behavioural responses, I think being assertive is often missing from the Christian response. We often miss the fact that what appears to be a hard performance issue can actually have a relational core. So the connection between workplace results and relationships may seem sometimes quite distant, but thinking relationally can throw a lot of light on problems. Take, for example, the issue of prison riots. Okay, here's a prison. Well, there was a prison. Isn't there? That was a fortuitous mistake, wasn't it? Obviously, the slide's in the wrong order. Anyway, prison riots. That was the slides being assertive. Prison riots are blamed on a breakdown of communication between the staff and the prisoners, right? That's usually what they say is the cause. Now, a relational audit in the prison showed that the best paid job for a warden is to sit in the control room watching the video screens for signs of trouble. So the best wardens, the people who've got the most ability to relate to the inmates and build trust with them, end up in the control room. Yeah? Instead of walking the floors, picking up the vibes, defusing the arguments, and creating dialogue. So what's happened is that a decision about pay grades has had a bad relational impact and produced an even worse operational result. Now, wise relational thinking would have placed a higher financial value on the critical interactive roles. And every organisation is critically dependent on certain relationships. And thinking about the relational impact of decisions that we have, make about products or systems or pay grades or whatever, that affects the health of our organisation and whether it reaches its goal. So, how can we improve relationships? Let's take you and your relationships. Look back at that key relationship list you listed earlier and try to allocate those relationships into those that are going well, those that are okay but could improve, and those that are perhaps not so good, drifting apart, using the table in your notes. And I've put some helpful criteria on it. Think about transparency. How open are you with the person there? How open is appropriate? How much time do you spend with them? And how does that time leave you feeling? And is there mutual trust and respect in the relationship? Can you depend on them? Do you think they can depend on you? So think about those criteria and then allocate your relationships into good, medium, and not so good. Okay? Okay, now once you've done that, now just turn and share with your neighbour or neighbours why you think the good relationships are good and what's gone wrong with the bad ones. Okay? Just have a bit of interaction. Share what you think has been good about the relationship, what that you think is good, and what's gone wrong with the poor ones. Thank you. One more minute. Okay, let's come back together. I have the feeling I could leave you talking for half an hour on this. But anybody want to volunteer a factor that makes a relationship really positive? Tell me something good. Yes.
Spending time with them.
Spending time with them. Great. What about the opposite? Yeah?
Which one do you want?
You go on, keep going positive.
Okay, positive is a mutual respect and love that is shown in every way, in conversation, in time together, and in sharing.
Excellent, yeah, good. Third one? Yeah.
Common aims.
Common aims, great. You're doing the seminar for me now, that's great. Okay, what about the negatives then? What are the factors that have driven a bad relationship?
When you can't say, we can't be honest and transparent because
okay, can't be honest, yeah. Another one? Yeah.
When the opposite, of course, of being good, it's a very one-sided relationship. We have two sets of friends. When we're with them, they are merely using the time as a platform to broadcast to us what they're doing, what their interests are.
Right, okay.
We stay friends because it's been years since we knew them.
Yeah, okay. And one more negative?
Not spending enough time with them.
Not spending enough time. Good. Yeah, okay. So, now how can we improve these? And actually, you've already started giving some clues. I want to look at this problem through two lenses. First of all, a structural lens. And that means analysing a relationship, which is partly what you started to do just there, and then choosing to do something different about it. And then secondly, a situational lens, which is changing our everyday responses to the interactions that we have. So, first of all, structurally, sometimes when we recognise a poor relationship, there is a structural reason behind it, something systematic in the way the relationship is being handled. That causes it to suffer. Now, over the last 20 years, the Jubilee Centre in Cambridge, think tank founded by a man called Michael Schluter, has identified five factors that tend to predict or to lead to what he calls relational proximity or closeness. And these are based on his study of the Jubilee laws in Leviticus, which do carry a lot of God's relational heart. Now, these five dimensions I've represented on this pentagram here, and they are, and you've already mentioned some of them in your responses, they are communication, story, common purpose, information about each other, and power, parity of power. Okay? Now, I'll go through these in a bit more detail. Communication. Yeah, we have no Wi-Fi, talk to each other, pretend it's 1995. Now that's the most obvious key to any relationship, isn't it? But true communication is not just about the transfer of information. The quality of the communication is vital, and direct contact makes a huge difference. Direct contact. If you've ever worked in an open plan office, you will know that despite people being easy to reach, they still send emails to each other in the next cubicle. You know, why is that? Well, it's sort of, you know, easier. They don't have to get up. We get bound up with our technology and the result is far less effective or satisfying. Whereas when we're there in person, there is a transparency, there is a richness of human interaction, of communication. You can see the whites of their eyes. You can shake hands on an agreement. You can correct misunderstanding that you might agonise over on an email. And we all know the statistic that in any oral communication, words make up as little as 7% of the total message. The rest is the tone of voice, the facial expression, the gestures, the body language, and so on. So face-to-face contact makes a huge difference. If we can't be physically present in a relationship, then probably Skype would be the next best thing, because we can both see and hear the other person. If you can't Skype, then a telephone call is better than an email, because you can hear the other person's tone of voice and inflection and you can respond in real time. Now, poor communication is often at the base of a broken relationship, so it's a good place to start the repair as well. If possible, have a face-to-face dialogue. Secondly, story, continuity over time. Somebody said here, time together. There's something warming, isn't there, about the continuity of relationships over time, about being around people you know. You obviously recognise a few people on this slide. Those shared experiences over the years, they create a bond of trust, don't they? They give us greater understanding of each other and hopefully more trust. And if you know the history of your relationship, your momentum builds over time. If you've ever had that frustrating experience of telephoning a call centre, and I'm sure you have, yeah. And so you finally, you know, after a couple of years, you get through and you explain your problem, and a week later, nothing has happened, you know. So you call back, and guess what? You have to explain your problem all over again, and including, you know, the problem of the person who didn't take your query any further. Now, the more enlightened call centres now have your call history recorded on their screen. So when you call back, the person who answers the phone already knows what's been happening. They can see your story, and that improves relationship. It helps build understanding. Thirdly, common purpose. I think the Welsh football team have a much better common purpose here than the British one, don't you? The English one. Now, people and teams who are motivated by a clear common purpose tend to be more productive and more satisfied. People need to know how their work contributes to the overall mission and be convinced that the mission is indeed worthwhile pursuing. When we share the goals, it diffuses some of the personality tensions. And this is probably one of the most potent dimensions when it comes to repairing broken relationships, that being able to objectify the issues and find common ground about what we're trying to achieve, instead of personalising the dispute, which blocks the first dimension of communication. Then fourthly, information. Excuse me, what Michael Schluter calls multiplexity. That's people who see each other in more than one kind of context. They're more likely to develop and maintain deeper relationships in a context outside of work, like a bar, a cafe, a party or something. People can say more of what they really think or express perhaps a level of doubt or a lack of understanding that they might find it difficult to express in the goldfish bowl of operations. So knowing something about somebody's outside interests, about their background, their home life, it helps to better understand them and sometimes why they may make the kind of decisions they do, or even why they might be unusually grumpy today or stressed. And finally, there's power, or to be more accurate, the balance of power in the relationship. Now, in the services, there's obviously a clear hierarchy. You have a command chain. But even in a command chain, in healthy relationships, there is still a mutual respect. There's still a sense of mutual respect and participation, so that some influence flows both ways in that command chain. But, you know, of course, in unhealthy relationships, you just feel intimidated. You just feel put down, and that makes you far less likely to participate with anything with enthusiasm. So, to deal successfully with broken relationships, it's vital that each party comes to recognise the need for some parity of influence, some level of mutual respect, that each person's got a valid contribution to make. See, Andrew's story earlier that I mentioned about being assertive is an example where he took responsibility to even up the power balance in the relationship. He didn't take his boss's place. He didn't try to usurp his position. He didn't change his positional power. But he exerted another kind of power, the power of his expertise in understanding the truth of the situation, and the power of his character, because his unusually direct and assertive response was so out of his normal character and demeanour that it commanded attention. He sort of won the battle in a way by the character that he was the rest of the time. And then, you know, when he spoke up, the boss realised there was something serious there. So this is the summary table. And that's a quick canter through these five structural dimensions. So by checking if one or more of these factors are weak or broken in a relationship, it can help us to take corrective action. So go back to your list of key relationships, pick one that is going really well and one that you would like to improve, and using the table on your handout, score each relationship on each of those five criteria. And as you do that, note down any insights this exercise gives you into why the good one is good and what you might be able to do to improve the poor relationship. So I'll give you a bit of time to think about that. Score each of those two relationships, the good one and the bad one, on those five criteria. Say score out of five, you know, five is good, one is bad. Okay. How are you doing? Have you done that? So any insight? Just take a poor relationship. You don't have to say who it is. Who's identified one of those five axes, one of those five dimensions as being particularly a problem in a poor relationship? Anybody that they can share what the axis is? Yeah.
Respect.
Mutual respect. Okay. So let's throw this open. If there's a problem of mutual respect in a relationship, how might you address that? Sorry?
Role model respect.
Role model respect, yes. Yeah. So you're kind of sensitised to that issue. There may also be a way of indirectly tackling it by talking to somebody who is also connected with that individual to find out if they've got the same issue. Not that we want to go third parties in relationship, but just to sort of research it a bit more. So, you see, by doing that, you think, okay, now this analysis has showed me this. Now, what can I structurally do to tackle that? Let's take another one. Anybody got another example? Yeah.
Yes, I've written down purpose for one of my poor relationships. I've given it a three.
Yeah.
A, because they self-project, and B, because we self-protect.
Right.
The protection system we use is to imagine a big hole in our stomach and everything they fire at us goes straight through without affecting us. If we don't do that, after an hour, we go home shriveled and feeling very weak and insecure.
Okay, so think about how might you address that, do you think?
We might fight back, but that seems to me too assertive and too aggressive because we've tried it and
yeah.
It makes the situation worse.
Okay. Any other ways?
We pray a lot.
How about how about dialogue? What if you raise, if you, you know, named the issue?
If we pause to take a breath, they'll straighten again with their point of view.
These are obviously lovely people to know.
We do, and we've known them for 50 or 60 years.
Mm. Wow, it's difficult, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll keep praying.
It's interesting though, isn't it, to sort of identify that issue, that it is a mutual...
It's quite helpful.
Yeah, okay.
The trouble is, some relationships are one-sided.
Can be.
Therefore, you know, as much as one can do oneself,
yeah.
It requires a response from the other party.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you don't get that, you know, what does one do? You know,
yeah.
One tries.
Yeah, well, you're only responsible for yourself, aren't you, not for the other party. But you can only try to influence, I agree. Somebody else was going to say something here.
Well, just in a sense, following up on that, that there can be sometimes a degree of toxicity
yes.
in a relationship, which means that any attempts to improve it are quite easily subverted, and that kind of relationship is extremely difficult and may, I suggest, may be miracles apart, unsalvageable.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's true. I think, you know, there are very... very difficult situations.
There's another way it could be to try and emulate the behaviour that you want them to project you to them.
Yes.
In a more obvious manner, maybe.
Yeah, well, that's what the lady back there was saying about respect, I guess. Yeah.
But actually, model behaviour.
Yeah, modelling it.
Modelling it, yeah. What you want them to do.
Yeah. Yeah, another thing you can think about is the way Jesus, if you look through the Gospels, if you can find an example in the Gospels of somebody who treated Jesus in the same way as you're being treated. And then see how he responded to that. Yeah. Now, it's, you know, it's not a one-for-one match, but you know, what about the man who called out, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." You know, And he immediately came back. He said, "Who appointed me judge over the two of you?" You know, just basic straight assertion back. No, in other words, I'm not going to do that. So, you know, there are some interesting responses by Jesus in situations. Okay, I'm going to have to move on because of time, I think. But let's look at this second lens, this situational lens, the day-to-day relational working. Now, I want to use a biblical example for this, the church in Rome. And the background to this is that the church in Rome had a mixture of Christians with a Jewish heritage and Gentile Christians. They've been brought together with a common cause, their faith in Jesus, but there's tension between them because those with a Jewish background feel that their heritage as the people of God somehow gives them a higher place in the holy hierarchy than these latecomers. And the Gentile Christians feel that they're the new guard. You know, the old covenant people had their chance and blew it, so now they are the new chosen people of God. And so this is, in some senses, not unlike workplaces I have known. They're rivals. They're, trying to put themselves above the other one. There's inter-team rivalry, some putting others down, a sense of superiority, trying to prove who's best or discredit the other people in the eyes of others, and so on. Now, Rome was quite strategic in Paul's eyes. We get the benefit of his theological tour de force in the book of Romans, explaining carefully why Jew and Gentiles alike have an equal salvation. We're all God's children, we're all co-heirs with Christ. But then he goes on in chapter 12 to describe what Christian love looks like in practice, first within and then outside of the church. So this is some good advice that we can note for what to do when things get rough relationally. Love must be sincere. Hate what is evil, cling to what is good. Be devoted to one another in love. Honour one another above yourselves. Never be lacking in zeal, but keep your spiritual fervour serving the Lord. Be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, faithful in prayer. Share with the Lord's people who are in need. Practice hospitality. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Mourn with those who mourn. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be proud, but willing to associate with people of low position. Do not be conceited. Do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Do not take revenge, my dear friends, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, "It is mine to avenge. I will repay," says the Lord. On the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. So the point here is that as we learn to love the strange mix of people that God's put into the church, it's not meant to stay into the church, but to spill out into the world around us, into our workplaces, where it will be tested severely by people who will not at first reciprocate this kind of love. And much of Paul's advice translates well into common workplace situations. Maybe somebody's got it in for you, you know, you're starting to really dislike them, you feel persecuted, but we're encouraged to bless them. That is so challenging, isn't it? There's so much a test of our authenticity as Christians. Some are rejoicing at promotion, some are mourning at failure. Can you join with them either way, even when they got the promotion that you wanted? Perhaps there's relational conflict, and to be honest, you really believe it's their fault. Do your best to live at peace. Find ways to be reconciled, if at all possible. Or you've been hurt, you've been betrayed even, you want your own back. Forgive them. Leave them to God. How hard is that? How much of a test is that of Christian love? But forgiveness is very powerful. I had a lady working for me some years ago, just after I took over as finance director, and my predecessor told me that she had awarded a contract to an outside company in which her boyfriend worked without putting it through the proper tendering process. It was a pretty small amount of money, but he'd find out about it. I'm surprised she kept her job, actually, but he'd frozen her pay for an extended period as a discipline for that. And she didn't know that I knew about it. And 3 weeks into my new job, she came to see me and told me the whole thing, including the fact that she was now breaking up with her boyfriend, who was threatening to phone me to discredit her and ruin her career. And I said to her, I'll change her name to Catherine, I said, well, Catherine, as far as I'm concerned, this is forgiven now, and I trust you to run your department to the best of your ability. And, you know, her eyes filled up with tears, and she said thank you. And I don't think I ever had a more committed person after that. You know, there is room for forgiveness at work. Now, that doesn't mean to say we're complete idiots and a soft touch. The following day, actually, I had to deal with the case of a man who'd stolen a computer out of our warehouse. He'd been caught on video, denied it. His supervisor had fired him. He appealed, and it came up to me before going to a tribunal. So we got him in the room, we played him the video, and he still denied it, and I fired him. Because justice is also necessary for the good order of society. But there's such a lot of room for forgiveness. There is such a lot of room for grace at work. Maybe there's that frankly really unpleasant person who needs your professional help, and this is an opportunity to overcome evil with good. I just want to linger on that pivotal verse that helps us understand the principle underlying these specific words of advice. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. I wish I could say I was able to do that all the time, but that is what we are, really. Blessing is what God does. This is rare in the workplace, and it stands out because the temptation is to sacrifice other people on the altar of our own best interest, isn't it? But blessing wants the best for the other person, even at our own expense. And it can only come from deep within us. John Ortberg speaks of blessing being done by the soul, our whole person. We think it, we feel it, we will it, we communicate it through our body language. You can't fake blessing. And true blessing carries that spirit of blessing, that of all blessings that we find in Numbers. The Lord bless you and keep you. In other words, do good, protect you. The Lord make his face to shine on you and be gracious to you. Show you favour, exercise grace towards you. The Lord turn his face towards you and give you his peace. Be fully present with you. Offer you his shalom. That is God's heart for Israel. Could it be our heart for those around us to do them good, to protect them? And so on. I'm just going to finish with a little clip again from Sarah's story.
I'd like to tell you Sarah's story. Sarah's a scientist in an NHS hospital. She's a very nice person, just like all her colleagues. Her team is caring, they're supportive, they do a really good job working together. And as she says, it's hard to be distinctive as a Christian when everyone is so nice. So she started talking to God about it, because she's a quiet sort of person, someone who doesn't naturally talk about matters of faith in everyday conversation. And God answered her and gave her a direct challenge. A challenge to start to think carefully about ambition, to create opportunities for other people to develop and to flourish. Sarah isn't a manager yet, but equally she's no longer the most junior person in the team. She's got a degree of experience, she's got a degree of seniority, and she's realized she can make a difference in people's working lives by the opportunities that she's able to put their way. And God has helped her to see ways in which she can help her colleagues and her subordinates gain some experiences that will advance their own careers. And to some extent, she's foregoing her own opportunities by sharing those experiences out with others in a way that benefits them. And so what she started to do was, with new projects, with new equipment, and new patient cases to consider, she started to share those out with others. And she senses her colleagues trust her more now than they might otherwise have done. It's been a really good way, she told me, to get to know people, to develop relationships with them, because she can see that they take her seriously when she invests in them. And she knows she's showing them something of God's character when she does this. It's more than common niceness, a lot more. It's out-of-the-way generosity in the model of Jesus, who didn't come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many.
So this is a very big topic, isn't it? Just before we close, I'd like you to think, is there one concrete action that I can take as a result of this? I always like to try and bring it to an action when I've been talking. You know, on your handout, there's a space. What would be one concrete action you could take in the area of relationships that might have come out of the discussion this evening? Maybe it's something structurally, maybe it's something about your own response. But I pray that you'd have something that you could take away and be a blessing to others. So thanks very much. Nicola, do you want to say anything?
Yep.